Our final speaker today is Edward Latessa. He's a professor and head of the Division of Criminal Justice at the University of Cincinnati. And you know, when I looked at your CV on Sunday, something popped out at me that I hadn't noticed the last time I looked at it. Your PhD is from Ohio State. And I hadn't really noticed it until, you know, Sunday morning. You know, the Buckeyes are an amazing team, aren't they? You know, national champions, 19-game winning streak. You know, you kind of hate to see such a good team lose, but to all of us loyal Badger fans who were sitting in the rain on Saturday night, they couldn't have lost to a better team. Go Badgers! So Professor Latessa has published 75 journal articles and book chapters in the area of criminal justice, corrections, and juvenile justice. He's co-author of 7 books, including Corrections in the Community in its 3rd edition, Corrections in America in its 10th edition. He's conducted 60 funded research projects, including studies of day reporting centers, drug courts, drug programs, halfway houses, intensive supervision, and juvenile justice programs. He and his staff have evaluated 350 correctional programs across the country, including programs here in Wisconsin. He's been president of the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences. He's received several awards. I'm just going to mention one, the Margaret Mead Award for Dedicated Service to the Causes of Social Justice and Humanitarianism from the International Community Corrections Association. He's a consultant with the National Institute of Corrections. He's provided assistance and workshops in over 35 states. He's going to be talking today about saving the state dollars by investing in correction programs proven to work. And Dr. Latessa not only talks about saving the state money, he's actually contributing to the state coffers by paying out-of-state tuition for his daughter to attend the University of Wisconsin here in Madison. All I can say is keep those kids coming. We'll give them a good education here. The title of his talk is Promoting Public Safety Through Effective Correctional Intervention. What we're
Thank you. Thank you. And I should mention that my other 3 children are all going to Ohio State University. So just so you know that. I'm going to start with the overhead and then move to the high tech stuff because some of the questions that were asked. And the basis of my the paper that Karen included was an article we wrote called Correctional Quackery, in which we really talked about the lack of evidence-based practice in corrections. And if you think about the billions of dollars, I think we're spending $50 billion this year across the country in corrections. It's one of the few areas where we can kind of get away with doing whatever we want without looking at the research. And I just want to quickly just kind of walk through. This is what many folks do when they design correctional programs. We call it the Christopher Columbus style of program design. When they set out, he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got back, he didn't know where he'd been. And I want to point out he did it twice. And he did it with state money. And over the years, these are some of the theories that we've come across in the programs that we've evaluated. I'm not going to go through all of them, but these are some of the common theories that we hear when we go out and look at correctional programs. We're starting with kind of the been there, done that theory, and that goes something like this. I don't need any research to tell me what works. I know what works because I've worked with offenders for 20 years. And of course, that's a difficult model to implement. How do you make sure your staff are delivering the been there, done that theory? How do you make sure they understand it? And usually the person that's telling me that's in a big corner office, and they haven't really seen any offenders in about 10 years, other than when they go get coffee and they're out in the hallway. This is a common one with juveniles. Offenders need to get back to nature theory. That's where we take these kids and we send them up to, you know, camp out and cook their own food and kind of do these experiential activities. We call them wilderness programs. We call them bonding delinquents together is what we call it. In Ohio, we call those gangs. I don't know what you call them here. Of course, we've got the discipline, you know, that we just have to teach them respect and march them around and get tough with them. Those are boot camps. This one, California, we need to change our diet theory. That's a California one. This is a mental health one we find a lot. We did a mental health program once, and we could not figure out what they were trying to do. And finally, they told us we just want them to be happy. So we have happy offenders in that program. And this last one's always my favorite. And this one is basically that male offenders need to get in touch with their feminine side theory. And that goes something like this. The reason us men are aggressive brutes is we're just not sensitive enough. I've actually seen it in several forms, but my favorite was one where they dressed the men up as women. They had to dress in drag in the groups. So if you're ever mugged in New Jersey by some ugly-looking guy in a dress. Now, I people have a tendency to think that I make some of this stuff up, but I'm not all that creative. So I'm going to show you a few recent ones that we've collected. This one I like. This is Gardening Conquers All. How to cut your jail recidivism rates by half. Half, mind you. All right? So here all along, we didn't know we could reduce our population in jails by half just by having them do gardening. And somebody actually called me the other day and said they were going to do a gardening program for offenders. What did I think they'd get? And I told them vegetables is what they would get. Here's another one. I like this one. My friends in Georgia sent me this one because they were trying to sell this program to the Georgia Department of Corrections. This is called Drum Circles. And she says here, she introduced the first drum circle in a New Zealand prison, and she describes it as wow. That's the data that they have, wow. The staff was amazed because most clients continued drumming for 2 hours without stopping the smoke. I can assure you, if I'm in a cell with you and you drum for 2 hours, it will not reduce my recidivism rate. And this is a new one. This is running teaches inmates the value of success. And here I thought we didn't want them to run. Eh? So these are some of the obviously what will fall into the quackery category. I want to talk a little bit about what we do know, and I don't have a lot of time, obviously, so I'm going to kind of focus on some principles, because these are the principles that have been gleaned from really 20 years or so, maybe more, of research about what's effective and what isn't in reducing recidivism. And you have to think about how these principles apply to your state. We know that treatment programs can significantly reduce recidivism. We've got years of evidence of that, if we do things, we do them well, we can get strong effect sizes. Right? The most effective programs meet certain principles, and these are the three of the principles that have been delineated, starting with the risk principle, target higher risk offenders. That's the who of the principles. And if you stop and think about it for a minute, and I think Steve's discussion about how we've over-incarcerated people, we've lost that kind of diminishing return. If you think about a state like Wisconsin, any state, and let's assume for a minute that half of the people that come out of your prisons never come back again, which half are we concerned about? The half that are going to come back or the half that aren't going to come back? Well, we're concerned about those half that are going to come back. They pose the most risk to the public. They're the ones we want to focus most of our attention on. The need principle is the what to target. Correctional programming has to target criminogenic risk factors. When we target running and gardening and self-esteem and creative abilities and physical conditioning, we don't get very far, because they're not correlated with criminal conduct. And so the need principle is very important, because it really says you have to focus on the right things. And the treatment principle basically says use behavioral approaches. Why? Because they show the strongest effects. The risk principle, I don't like when all this, this will take us a while here. Target offenders with higher probability of recidivism. provide the most intensive treatment to higher risk offenders. And the problem is when we focus on lower risk offenders, we actually increase their recidivism rates. And so there we get to a policy, as I'll show you in a few minutes, where we're spending money to increase recidivism. The need principle basically says target antisocial attitudes, antisocial friends, substance abuse, lack of empathy, impulsive behavior, what we call criminogenic risk factors. And there's a much longer list than that. I've just abbreviated it. But targeting non-criminogenic factors, again, things like anxiety, low self-esteem, physical conditioning, aren't going to lead to big reductions because they're not correlated with risk. This is an example from a meta-analysis that shows and illustrates that programs that target at least 4 to 6 more criminogenic needs are producing effect sizes over 30%. Programs that target 1 to 3 more non-criminogenic needs basically show no effect. Okay? And so it's not just what you target, it's how much you target. High-risk offenders almost never have just one risk factor. They're not going to be high risk just because of one risk factor. They've got a number. They're unemployed. They have no education. They hang around with criminals. They think what they're doing is okay. They don't have strong families. They have multiple risk factors, and so we have to target multiple risk factors for those individuals. The treatment principle says that most effective interventions are behavioral. They focus on current factors that influence behavior, not past factors. And of course, the reason's simple. We can't change the past. And so these programs that like to do insight and Freudian approaches and talk therapies aren't very effective. Behavioral treatment programs are action-oriented. They teach new skills. They don't try to talk the offender into changing. Why? Because it's not a very effective approach. Right? Most of us don't learn new skills because someone talks to us for a couple hours. We learn because we do it. We practice it. We reinforce it. And, of course, that's the third element. And you can see from meta-analysis, we see almost 30% effect sizes from behavioral programs, and those are numbers of studies there. This is adult. Juvenile, we see the exact same thing. Non-behavioral programs produce very small effect sizes. The most effective models are structured social learning, where new skills and behaviors are modeled. And academics like to make things, I think, sometimes more complicated than what they are. Social learning is actually a pretty simple theory. Right? It's that we've acquired our attitudes and our values and our beliefs from the people around us, and they're reinforced and they're modeled. Right? We don't only learn good things, we learn bad things. Right? If you think about it for a minute, right? How many of you are parents? How many of you turned into your parents when you had children? Well, let me assure you that when you were 16, the last person you were ever going to be was your father or your mother. Right? I have 4 children, 3 teenagers, and my 16-year-old said to me the other day, when I'm a parent, I'm going to let my kids do whatever they want. I said, you go right ahead, Jennifer. Just be home at 11. Right? You say the things to your kids you swore you'd never say. Were you born in a barn? Do you think money grows on trees? I said to my son the other day, do I look like Rockefeller? He said, who the hell is Rockefeller, man? I said, Bill Gates. Do I look like Bill Gates? Right? Structured social learning is when we try to take an environment and structure pro-social behavior. A lot of programming tries to do that. Cognitive approaches are the most common out there today. They're very transportable. We can do them anywhere, in prisons, jails, schools. There's a lot of good cognitive curriculums. Wisconsin's developed some, by the way. You have some good cognitive programs in this state. And family-based approaches, especially for juveniles. Multifunctional or functional family therapy, multi-systemic therapy. A question was asked about domestic violence offenders. I just read a meta-analysis of studies of domestic violence treatment. And what it said was the effects at best are moderate. At best, we get moderate effects with domestic violence offenders. But the strongest effects were from cognitive behavioral approaches. It basically said that's the only way to go if you're going to provide treatment to domestic violence offenders. Non-behavioral approaches, things like drug prevention classes, things like DARE, really have shown no effects in research. Drug education programs, we spend incredible amounts of time and money. We mandate it that we have to teach offenders about drugs. Right? Trust me, they know a lot about drugs already. Non-directive approaches, have them read books, self-help programs, vague unstructured rehab. These are things that are not very effective. Now, I want to talk just in my little bit of time I have left about a study that we recently did in Ohio that I think will show you how strong these principles were supported by the research. This is the largest study ever done of community-based correctional treatment programs. We tracked 13,000 offenders that had been sent to 37 halfway house and 15 community-based correctional facilities in the state of Ohio. We did a two-year follow-up of all offenders, and we looked at rearrest and incarceration in a state penal institution. We also looked at program characteristics. Very quickly, about half of our experimental sample were men and women who went to prison and then were placed in a halfway house. Wisconsin, I know, does a lot of halfway house programming like Ohio does. The other half of our experimental group were offenders who never went to prison. These were men and women put on probation and placed in a treatment facility. So that's everybody, right? That's the guys and women that went to prison. That's the men and women that got in trouble and didn't go to prison. Our control group were about 5,800 offenders released from parole at the same time. We matched them. We gave everybody a risk score. And I won't get into how we did that. But we wanted to compare low-risk offenders who went to a program to low-risk offenders who didn't go to a program. High-risk offenders who went to a program to high-risk offenders who did not go to a program. What do we find with regard to the risk principle? This is the treatment effect for incarceration for low-risk offenders. Let me tell you how to read this chart. That's every program in Ohio that we studied at the bottom. The names are irrelevant, except to them. All right. The red lines, these graphs here, are showing you how much worse low-risk offenders did who were placed in a program. You can see here that the majority of programs actually increased the recidivism rates for low-risk offenders. So this one here, for example, low-risk offenders that were placed in this program had a 36% higher recidivism rate than low-risk offenders who were not placed in a program. Only a small handful of programs actually had an effect. This is the treatment effect for high-risk offenders. It's the opposite. You can see here, most of the programs actually reduced recidivism, 8 of them over 20%, and 3 of them over 30%. Now, you don't think that's a lot. Let me remind you, there were 13,000 offenders in this study. And so what if every program in Ohio reduced recidivism by 30% and all the offenders were high risk? 30% of 13,000, okay, is over 4,000 offenders. Okay? And remember, our outcome measure here is going back to prison. Okay? Here's where you really see the risk principle, down here at the end. Let's take this program here. This program, Mahoning County, this is my hometown, they reduced recidivism for high-risk offenders by 32%. Mahoning County increased recidivism for low-risk offenders by 29%. So the same program that's having a substantial effect on high-risk offenders is actually increasing the recidivism for low-risk offenders. As I said to Ohio, why would you spend $60 a day to increase recidivism rates? In Ohio, it's simple. We're not going to put low-risk people into these programs anymore. They do better on supervision. By the way, the risk principle held up for sex offenders as well. Right? You can see here, low-risk sex offenders that were placed in a program, their recidivism rate almost doubled. High-risk offenders who were placed in a program, sex offenders, their recidivism rates were reduced by 40%. Why would we think putting low-risk sex offenders in with high-risk sex offenders would be a good strategy? What do we find with regard to the need principle? Well, what we found was programs, and we were very generous here, if they were only 25% criminogenic, they reduced recidivism on average about 5%. Not bad, not great, but look at here. If they were less than 25% criminogenic, they actually increased recidivism by 16%. That's a 21-point swing in recidivism when you see what they target. What do we find with regard to the treatment principle? Programs that were cognitive behavioral, on average, had an 8% reduction in recidivism. Being cog. Everything else, every other kind of program, educational, 12-step, faith-based, eclectic, had no effect, had none. And we also looked at, remember, part of behavioral programs is they're action-oriented. So did they engage the offenders in techniques like role-playing? Well, if they did it consistently, they reduced recidivism 9%. If they did it only occasionally, they had a very small effect. In Ohio, the overall treatment effect was only 4%. When we put all of the data together, Ohio was spending about $80 million a year to reduce recidivism, about 4%. But look at the swing. We had programs in Ohio that increased recidivism 41%. We had programs in Ohio that reduced recidivism 43%. Why? Well, when we started putting program factors together, we started to see this cumulative effect on recidivism. Programs that had a termination rate in an acceptable range. In other words, about 3 out of 4 offenders who went into the program completed the program. That gave them about a 5% effect size, reduction in recidivism. If the program was at least 3 years old, another 5%. If it was cognitive, they got up to 18%. If 25% of the services targeted criminogenic risk factors, they got up to 23%. If they role-played all of the time, they got up to 32%. And if they varied treatment based on risk level, they got up to 39%. So who you target, what you target, and how you target it makes a big difference in designing effective correctional programs. And I'm probably out of time, right? So I will stop.
When you looked at community options, halfway houses and community-based corrections facilities, how did you get the acceptance of the communities?
How did we get the acceptance? It was a state-funded study. They had no choice. Basically, the state wanted to know, we're spending all this money on these programs, how effective are they? So it was kind of a mandated study. And in defense of them, most of them welcomed it. Most of the they've really used this to their advantage, because they've been able to go in and argue that most of the programs are showing an effect, and so they've been able, I think, to use the study to show where they have been working. And then of course there were 8 programs that actually increased recidivism for everybody, but that was really a program integrity issue, and so the state is spending a lot of effort to improve those programs. Because in some cases they're in areas where it's the only program they have, and so that they can't simply eliminate them. They want to continue them, but we didn't have a lot of resistance. We're doing a companion study now of all of the probation-funded programs. And surprisingly, they want a bigger study than what the state even wants to fund. So there's actually been good support out there. As an aside, we did find, I didn't show the data, but when there was strong community support for the program, its effectiveness increased as well. We did find that, just as an aside. Yes? Well, that's a good, okay. The question is, when do you start interventions, especially if they're incarcerated? Do you start them when they come in? Do you start them when they leave? Here's the problem. The problem is that if you provide good behavioral treatment to a group of incarcerated offenders and then you put them back into the general population, the effects all go away because the social learning is all antisocial. That doesn't mean, however, that some programming cannot begin early. Educational programming, work programming. I mean, there are obviously things that you can start. But most states are pushing now to design their programming to get the most effect is that kind of that 3 to 9 months before those inmates leave the institution. And then they move into transitional kind of programming. We do see about half the effects, by the way, from institutional programming than we do community programming. And so I think it really points to the need to have continuation programming when they come out of the institution, except for lower risk. Lower risk clearly do better just by being supervised. Yes. I'm taking your job.
Is there anything to show... Okay, when the prisoners come out of these programs, they go back into society and they're either on the white side of the racial divide or not.
Race was not a predictor. It did not matter in our study. And Ohio's probably 70% of the inmates coming out are African American. So we have a disproportionate, significantly disproportionate number. Race is an important kind of responsivity factor in terms of treatment and programming and so forth, but it's not it wasn't the determining factor as to whether someone was successful or not. Whether they're successful or not was the kind of programming they received, their hook into employment, and good treatment was much more important than just whether you were a man or a black or white or man or woman. Gender didn't matter either, by the way.
Risk assessment between high and low risk offenders, is that a fairly simple or is there enough data there to is it credit
yeah,
scoring gives you that?
It's a well established, it's probably the easiest thing to fix in corrections, that we have a number of third generation risk and need assessment instruments that have been out a long time. Wisconsin, of course, the Wisconsin instrument, which was developed about 30 years ago, was one of the first kind of third generation instruments. It's still widely used, but we have many more instruments that have improved on it. But that is one of the areas that's probably the easiest thing to address. And by the way, we have to remember risk. You know, risk is a culmination of risk factors, both static and dynamic. So, you know, things like criminal history are good risk predictors, but you can't change them. Right? Who you hang around with is a great risk predictor, and it's something you can target for change. And so the best instruments bring together dynamic and static factors into a way that not only gives you an idea of this individual's risk level, but allows you then to reassess them over time to see if their risk is reduced. So that's kind of where we're at with risk assessment today. But it's a well-established protocol. There's tons of options out there for risk assessment. Terry.
Can you speak into the mic, please?
Yeah. I think this kind of relates to this gentleman's question also. When looking at community programs, where obviously the highest effective interventions have occurred, mm-hmm. particularly when we look at our residential types of programs, I think part of this gentleman's question is, how do you get communities to accept residential programs in the first place.
Okay.
And second of all, if the most effective work is done with high-risk offenders, generally speaking, communities, power elites, et cetera, like to serve low-risk offenders, but the effect is best of utilization of that money in high-risk offenders. How do we make that translation into the community?
That's a good question. And I think we have to start, though, by understanding that what the public usually means by risk is related more to the offense than to the risk level of the offender. They don't want serious offenders in the community. You know, the Canadians have quit using the word risk. They call it low probability for successful reintegration. But that's too complicated for me, so I use the word risk. That's always going to be a challenge, especially when you're talking about specific populations like sex offenders, right? Because there's tremendous resistance. We have, I think, in Ohio, two programs specifically in the community for sex offenders. And that's we're a state that's got 40,000 offenders in prison, so we're very large, and we can't nearly accommodate the number of sex offenders that are coming out. That's always going to be a challenge. But I think when we start, when we start looking at risk a little bit differently, what we find is that about 20% of the individuals that are coming out of institutions and are in the community would be better served not being in a program. They have the low risk characteristics. There's also that high end of the spectrum. You notice I don't say the highest risk. You know, when we get up to that top 10 or 15%, those kind of high risk psychopathic offenders, we really don't have any effective treatment for those individuals. And the best strategy then often is incapacitation. In the Ohio study, for example, when we created our risk instrument, there were a number of offenders that scored at the very high level. Virtually all of them failed. Virtually all of them failed. And so, when we look at that band, what we're really talking about is kind of moderate to high, not the very high, and of course not the low, which we ought to have a different strategies for. But that's a good assessment. That's an assessment issue too. I mean, what the problem is, we don't assess them. We shove them in, and we kind of all assume that they're the same, and they're not. So assessment's really the engine that drives good programs, because it's going to tell you who can we be successful with. If we don't do good assessment, we're not going to know that.
And as a follow-up to that, in terms of assessment, obviously you've got the court system following our legislative path,
right,
or you've got the correction system trying to decide what to do with the prisoner once they're an inmate.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be doing something more, giving the courts more discretion in terms of making some kind of assessment before they hand down the sentence, or just letting corrections deal with it once the prisoner's in?
Well, different folks do it different ways, and I'm not sure I can answer that completely. Let me just say that there, in some states, for example, in Idaho, they have legislated assessment. And they pay for it. And so they have said, for example, for drug courts, you must use these instruments to assess offenders. To the Department of Corrections, they have said, we will pay for it, but we want good assessment. And so there's an example where the legislature has given them a little discretion and some money, but has basically said, we want good assessment. I just left Oregon. I was in Oregon this week, and they are the first state to pass legislation requiring by 2005, I believe, that their agencies, Human Services, Corrections, and Juvenile Justice, that by 2005, 25% of their programs have to be evidence-based. And by 2007, 50% have to be evidence-based. So here, this is the first state that's actually put some statutes in place that says, we don't want things that haven't demonstrated effectiveness. Like Steve said, there's a lot of, we have a lot of evidence out there. We have a lot of, we can point to a lot of interventions that have shown effect. And so I think that trend is starting. Oregon's a pretty progressive state, but I see they're getting a lot of interest from other states about how they put that, putting that in place.
In the remaining time, we can direct questions to any of our speakers, any of the speakers. Oh, okay.
Thank you. Thank you. I think that we're talking about an after effect. Oftentimes, state pass laws that take away the power of discipline, both from the parents and from the teachers in school. And when you're a grandparent, you look at things a little bit differently than the younger generation. How do you find, as you do your research, about the ability of a parent to discipline a child without being sent to prison because they disciplined that child? How many times have you gone to a mall and you had a child screaming and hollering, and the mother doesn't dare take that child and say, okay, kid, I've had enough of this crap. I want you to behave. How many times do we allow that to happen? The other thing is when you get to school, in grade school, high school, and a child misbehaves, I know we have a lot of legislation that says you must not touch a child. Well, I'm sorry. There are a whole lot of us got slapped on the behind, and it didn't kill us, nor did it hurt us. But we at least realized when somebody said no, they meant no. And how does that impact have on the kinds of research that you're doing? Has the younger generation been given too much leeway, or have parents been scared to death to discipline?
Well, let me say this. I think that we do know that, you know, family, the domain of family is a kind of a major risk need factor, that, you know, low levels of affection, caring, cohesiveness, poor parental supervision, poor discipline practices contribute to risk factors. But often those poor discipline practices would include physically harming a child. That is, what we really have to teach parents are appropriate ways to shape behavior of youth. You know, how to be a good parent, how to reinforce appropriate behavior. And where we're doing a lot of that, unfortunately, is in our prisons. We have a lot of parenting programs in prison, but that's kind of after the horse has gotten out of the barn. So I do think that criminology right now is taking a new interest in early intervention and in looking at kind of early onset and family and identifying children at risk in schools. And I think we're starting to move in that direction. But for a long time, it's been a neglected area, at least in terms of criminology. It's just not been something that's been on the radar screen in a while. Social learning, that Apple theory, that's social learning. And we do know that things like, you know, family criminality, prior abuse, those are pretty strong contributors to criminal behavior. But if somebody's father's in prison, that's a risk factor. It helps explain why they get into trouble. But we can't do much about it. I mean, for that individual. There is a lot of work being done in Oregon in the Social Learning Institute that really is looking at developing better curriculums for family reunification, parenting, programs that can address some of these issues. But it's really outside of my area, to be honest.
We do have a briefing report on this. We brought in a speaker from the Social Learning Center a couple years ago to talk about the prediction of juvenile crime, and they talked particularly about the prediction of violent offenders, and these violent offenders who often become repeat offenders. It often starts early in the home with inconsistent parenting during those preschool years. The parents yell a lot, they scream a lot, but they don't follow through. So these kids get kind of out of control. And then when they get into school, the teachers can't handle them, they get rejected by their peers, and they don't do well in school. So they end up with a lot of risk factors once they're in school. So they found at the Oregon Social Learning Center that starting earlier with these kids with early parent education has been extremely effective for the very violent offenders. It's similar to what you were saying, Ed. It works better for those kids who start early, become frequent, and then become violent offenders. But we do have a briefing report on that. It's on our website. If you leave your name with our staff, we'd be happy to send you a copy of this report that was written on that. Okay, we're almost done. Let's see. I think we can take one more question. Is there someone who hasn't asked a question that would like to ask a question? Okay. Any more? Anyone who hasn't asked a question that would like to? Question? Okay, one more. It has to be quick.
Surveys we've had in Wisconsin lately show that a white felon has a far greater chance of having his resume answered than a black non-felon. A white person has a much higher possibility of getting a mortgage than a non-white person. If you put that with these program outcomes, that means that if a black man goes through this successfully, he's a whopping success compared to the white man who succeeds because he's got way more difficulties to overcome. How is that accounted for in this risk assessment?
Professor Ortessa? It needs to be quick.
Yeah, it's... We've designed policies, especially around drug policies, that have disenfranchised large numbers of African Americans in terms of where they can live and that whether they can vote or not, the kind of jobs they can hold. So we've done some things, I think, by policy, especially with drug laws. You look at some of the federal statutes have clearly, denied opportunity for large numbers of our African American male community. You know, we have studied, there are some studies of work by Sherman and Todd Clear and others that are showing that in some of these inner city neighborhoods, high percentages of African American males can't hold certain jobs, can't vote, can't do certain things. And so I think we really have to take a hard look. It's hard to do rehabilitation and treatment programs when you cut people off from those kind of legitimate opportunities. So I don't think there's any question about that, but... Well, my work is really focusing on, are the predictors of criminality different for blacks and whites? That would be a question. And the answer basically is no. They're very similar. Does that mean that an African American or Hispanic doesn't have less opportunity? It doesn't mean that. But they're what contributes to their criminal conduct oftentimes are very similar. If you hang around with bad folks, if you have antisocial attitudes, if you drink and use drugs, if you don't have a job, if you're uneducated, it really doesn't matter if you're black or white. Okay? That is, those are risk factors. Okay? We see that over and over in the studies. But to get at your question, Ed, what happens then when you're confronted with, I can't get a job, I can't do this, I can't do that? Absolutely, then it contributes to their opportunity to reduce their risk. But in terms of the kind of the basic research, it's really pretty consistent.